Today's episode is sponsored by Factor. Factor makes meeting your nutrition goals easier than ever by delivering fresh, never frozen, dietitian-approved meals right to your doorstep. Their team of gourmet chefs create each meal using only ingredients with integrity to help you feel your best all day long. Eat stress-free this fall with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. You can choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Also, discover more than 60 add-ons every week, like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, and beverages to help you stay fueled and feel good all day long. And when things get hectic, Factor is flexible. You can change your order up every week with plans from 4 to 18 meals per week, or pause or reschedule your deliveries anytime. I personally love Factor when it comes to calorie and macro counting, which obviously is essential for anyone like me who's heading to the gym, on the go, or just trying to watch your calorie intake. Factor's got all the nutritional info clearly labeled and takes out the guesswork while also cutting down on trips to the grocery store and food prep. So get started today and fuel up your goals in life with the delicious convenience of Factor. Head to factor75.com or click the link below and use code LETSREAD50 to get 50% off your first Factor box and 20% off your next month of orders. That's code LETSREAD50 at factor75.com to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month of orders. What I'm about to tell you is a story so often told that it's passed into legend around the hills of Northwest Georgia. It's a tale of love, loss, and liquor. A story folks have been telling each other for almost 100 years. But unlike a lot of old myths and legends that you hear around these parts, this one is 100% true, and they got the documentation down in Cartersville to prove it. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the story of Fast Eddie Pettimore. According to his birth certificate, Edward Lee Pettimore Jr. was born on July 13th of 1904 in a little town called Varnal, just off of Route 2. His daddy was a mechanic, worked his way into fixing automobiles after they came commercially available, and could have ended up quite a wealthy man. But unfortunately for his family, Eddie Lee Sr. was a drunk, and sometimes only brought home maybe 1 or 2 days' wages a week. But then, in early 1920, the federal government instituted the Volstead Act, which banned the sale and manufacture of alcoholic beverages, and the era of prohibition had begun. Now, Eddie Sr. could have taken the opportunity to dry himself out and find his way back to Jesus, but he didn't want to live in a world where he couldn't get a drink, even if it meant living beyond his means. Yet in doing so, Eddie Sr. ended up owing money to the kind of folks you really don't want to owe money to. They gave him a choice: make weekly liquor runs up to Chattanooga, cross the Tennessee state line, or be found hanging from a poplar tree. Eddie Sr. chose the former, and after getting his hands on an old Model T, he chopped that thing down and souped up its engine until it was nothing short of hell on wheels. Eddie Sr.'s old Ford was now fit to outrun any cop car in America. The only problem was, he wasn't nearly as gifted a driver as he was a mechanic. One night, following a blistering pursuit by state revenue men, Eddie Sr. lost control of his vehicle, careened off the highway, and smashed into an oak tree doing almost 100 miles an hour. The revenue men following him didn't bother trying to put out the fireball. They let that bootlegger burn, and then simply waited to see who showed up missing. The crash left 17-year-old Eddie Jr. and his mama, a lady named Mary, with only one way of providing for themselves, and that involved Eddie Jr. approaching the bootleggers and offering to work on their automobiles. You see, to Eddie Jr., his dad had always been his hero, because from where he was standing, his deadbeat lush of a father had one day cleaned up his act, at least partially anyway, and had suddenly started bringing home hundreds of dollars a month. Eddie Jr. also noticed how skilled his daddy was at fixing up automobiles, and it was something that he paid attention to from a very early age. He might not have been anywhere near as experienced as his father, but he was the natural choice for the bootleggers who wanted someone who'd stay quiet and stay loyal. Eddie was obviously very eager to follow in his father's footsteps, not just because it meant providing for his family, but because he felt that Eddie Sr. would have been proud. The money was never an attraction. Most of it went to his mom anyway. Working with the bootleggers meant Eddie got to work on cars all day, and that's what made him happy. But what made him even happier was getting to drive them. Once he was a respected member of the bootlegging operation, Eddie's bosses started letting him test drive the cars that he worked on, just to make sure that they could handle being taken to full throttle. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is how they discovered Eddie was a goddamned natural. The bootleggers had carved out a kind of racetrack out there in the woods, and Eddie was beating the track times of some of their very best runners. So when Eddie was around 19 or 20, they asked him to start running liquor to Chattanooga for him, using almost the exact same route on which his father had lost his life. Every night, when Eddie told his mama that he was heading out and not to wait up for him, she'd worry herself sick. But she was just about the only one that did. Rumors started to run wild through local and state law enforcement. The bootleggers had a new driver and he seemed nigh unstoppable. Some officers had never seen anything like it and wondered how in the hell they were going to catch someone with such high levels of confidence and skill. This new guy did things no one else dared, and the cops started to think that the bootleggers had drafted in some kind of professional from out of state. Little did they know, it was young Eddie Jr. behind the wheel, and before long, Eddie's nickname was upgraded from Jr. to Fast Eddie. Fast Eddie was bringing home money hand over fist, with most of it going to his mom, but without a taste for the liquor that made him holler rich, as you might say, he didn't have much which to spend his personal portion of the treasure. He kept squirreling it away someplace, letting it accumulate, and only occasionally taking some out to buy new shoes or a birthday present for his mama. Automobiles were his whole life, so Fast Eddie didn't concern himself with much else. But then one day, some of his fellow runners decided it was time for a little bootlegger bar mitzvah, which involved driving him over to a cat house over near Cohutta to get him acquainted with some of the ladies there. Fast Eddie had never been with a woman before, and it said that he looked like a deer caught in headlights as all those peaches lined up in front of him, each looking fine as wine. Eddie had the cash to pick two, maybe even three girls, but he only chose one. A girl around the same age as him, named Lily May. Not much is known about young Lily May, only that she was an orphan, and then spent most of her life in an infamously unfit reformatory before finding employment at the Cohutta Cat House. Lily May had experience in such matters, and Fast Eddie did not. Then, true to the nickname he'd so deservedly earned, Eddie fell deeply and madly in love. According to folks who knew him, Eddie talked of nothing else but Lily May for a week straight, until finally, he drove on back to Cohutta Cat House and told Lily May that he wanted to marry her. The cat house madame laughed when she'd heard the news, and said it'd take $500 to buy Lily May out of service. Folks say that she looked just about plumb speechless when Eddie pulled out a wad of bills from his pocket, and then he and Lily May left hand in hand that very same day. As the story goes, Eddie moved his mama and Lily May into a place on Alpharetta Drive, just across from where Maple Grove Baptist Church stands today. And for about a year or two, they lived there in peace, with Eddie's identity as the bootlegger's ace runner being a closely guarded secret. But then one night, a rainstorm left the highways slicker than a greased pig, and for the first time in his career, Fast Eddie had lost control of his vehicle and was sent careening off the road. He managed to bring the car to a stop before it crashed into anything, but after coming to a halt in a patch of deep mud, Eddie realized that there was no getting the tires unstuck before the cops caught up with him. He jumped out of the driver's seat and then ran off into an orchard before the law saw where he went. Once he was at a safe distance, Eddie stopped, caught his breath, and reflected with relief on what a close call it had been. At least until he remembered that he'd left something behind. because stuck to the dash of the old Model T stock car was a photograph of his darling Lily May. Fast Eddie knew that he had to go into hiding, because now the county sheriff knew where he lay his head, and that same county sheriff happened to be the meanest son of a bitch this side of the Mississippi. Sheriff William Little Bill Harding was the grandson of a South Carolina slave catcher who ran for the hills come the end of the Civil War. Then his father had been a lawman who went by Big Bill. Big Bill was tough, but he was fair. Little Bill, on the other hand, was neither. In fact, I'd go so far as to say that he was a downright bully. No one around Whitfield County liked him, and even fewer people respected him. But folks learned quickly that to anger Little Bill, or even worse, to bruise his ego, was to invite a world of hurt upon yourself. By that point, Fast Eddie had been humiliating the law for years on end. So when Little Bill found out who'd been driving those stock cars and making them look like jackasses for so long, he was ready to rain fire and brimstone down on old Fast Eddie Pettimore. Sheriff Harding and his boys showed up to Eddie's place at the break of dawn and turned the house upside down in the hopes of finding him. They trashed the place, terrorized his wife and mama, but Eddie had long since departed. He was still doing liquor runs for his bootlegging buddies, and he still stopped by the house from time to time. But where he lay his head and where he kept his money remained a mystery to the county sheriff, as well as the state revenue men who were breathing down his neck. Night after night, Harding and his boys patrolled the highways northwest of Georgia, waiting and watching for any sign of Fast Eddie. Then in the twilight of a summer's evening back in 1924, two of Harding's pursuit vehicles were involved in a high-speed crash. One of his deputies lost his life. Eddie saw the crash unfolding behind him, and he knew it was a bad one, but he kept on driving towards the state line and made his delivery all the same. According to the bootlegger's routine, Eddie would make the delivery to Chattanooga in one vehicle, and then return in another, much less conspicuous one, and never via the same route. This meant that he didn't return home until daylight the next morning, at which point he'd retire to his hideout to sleep until late afternoon. But upon his return to Whitfield County that morning, Fast Eddie had a bad feeling in his gut and decided to stop by the house to check on his mama as well as his sweetheart, Lily May. Whenever Eddie rolled up to the house in the morning following a run, he'd always smell the fixings of a hearty southern breakfast. There'd be the aroma of sizzling sausage and bacon fat floating on the breeze, maybe the sweet scent of fried apples in there too. But on this particular morning, all Fast Eddie could smell when he opened up the door of his mama's house was the sour, metallic stink of spilled blood. Eddie's mama was nowhere to be found. But in the bathroom, lying in a white porcelain tub now stained with her blood, was the dead body of his darling Lily May. Her head had been bashed in with one of Eddie's lug wrenches, and sitting on a nearby bath mat was a note that simply said, "I didn't mean to hurt her," signed Edward Pettimore Jr. Little Bill Harding had avenged his fallen deputy, and in doing so, had framed Fast Eddie for the murder of his one true love. Eddie was accustomed to being a wanted man, but with word spreading that he was Lily May's killer, the young bootlegger had no idea who he could and could not trust. I've also no doubt that Sheriff and his boys anticipated some kind of retaliation. Hell, maybe some of them were even a little scared. But as the days went by and there was no sign of Fast Eddie on any of Georgia's highways, local lawmen started to believe that he'd simply turned tail and fled. Although not everyone believed that Eddie murdered Lily May, enough people bought it for him to lose his status as a plucky folk hero, and without being able to hide among the sympathetic, Eddie had no choice but to go on the run. Many months later, on a lazy Sunday afternoon, a couple of deputies were sitting in the Varnell Sheriff's Department when a car pulled into the parking lot and started honking its horn. They weren't expecting anyone, so they figured the honking was for someone in the city office on the other side of the parking lot. But then the driver kept honking, and honking, and honking, until eventually, Sheriff Harding barged out of his office and ordered the two deputies to silence the driver under pain of arrest. But when the two deputies walked outside, they saw the car idling in the parking lot, and that it was no ordinary vehicle. It was a stripped-down Buick Master 6, refitted with a state-of-the-art V8 engine, and sitting in the driver's seat was Fast Eddie Pettimore. The two deputies turned on their heels, ran back into the office, and yelled to the sheriff that none other than Edward Lee Pettimore Jr. was sitting in the parking lot outside. The sheriff ran out just in time to see Fast Eddie taking off southbound towards Tunnel Hill Road, and then after running to his own car, he and the two deputies took off after him, driving three different vehicles. In the past, Sheriff Harding knew that he and his boys could never catch up with Fast Eddie, but over the previous few months, they too had been chopping down their pursuit vehicles, making them lighter and lighter until they were just about ready to compete with the kind of greased lightning bolts that Fast Eddie drove. Meaning this time, they were ready for him. The sheriff and his boys were tearing down the highway at close to 100 miles an hour, intent on keeping the pedal to the metal until they caught sight of Fast Eddie's Buick. They must have gone for 15 to 20 miles. Each time they'd see a car ahead of them, and it turned out to be some innocent citizen, clinging to their wheel in terror as a bunch of siren-screeching stock cars burned past them on the highway. They kept on going, praying they hadn't wasted their opportunity until suddenly, Sheriff Harding saw a dark speck on the horizon. Believing it to be Fast Eddie, Harding pushed the engine of his stock car to the very limit in the hopes of catching up to him. And he didn't have to wait long. What happened next took place over the course of maybe 2 or 3 seconds. Harding spotted Eddie, and as the dark speck on the horizon grew larger, there was a split second when the sheriff believed that he was rapidly catching up. The only problem was, Eddie wasn't speeding away from him. Eddie was speeding towards him. But by the time Sheriff Harding realized what was happening, it was far too late to save himself. Fast Eddie smashed that Buick into Harding's Model T, at almost 110 miles per hour. And with the sheriff's own vehicle scraping triple-digit speeds, the impact was catastrophic. Both cars erupted into a firestorm of steel, shrapnel, and broken glass, which instantly ended the lives of both Fast Eddie and Sheriff Harding, while secondary impacts caused such serious injuries to one deputy that both of his legs required amputation. When the news hit that Harding had been murdered, and that Fast Eddie had been the one to do it, had sent shockwaves through the whole of Whitfield County. Some said Eddie was a delinquent, who'd murdered his wife, murdered the sheriff, and probably murdered his mama too since she was still missing. Others said that it must have been some kind of crazy accident because, while Eddie was many things, a bad driver he was most certainly not. But while all agreed that the income was completely unexpected, there's another thing folks are certain of too. And that's how Fast Eddie Pettimore's funeral enjoyed a much larger audience than Little Bill Harding's. Those that knew him, I mean, really knew him, didn't believe for a second that Eddie had murdered Lily May. But the folks who didn't know Eddie believed the headlines, and to them, he was a no-good wife slayer and a cop killer. Most people didn't give a good goddamn what anyone had to say about Eddie. But there was one person who cared enough to do something to salvage his reputation. Sometime later, a night train hailing all the way from Washington, D.C. rolled into Atlanta's terminal station, and from the first-class car emerged one of the most accomplished prosecuting attorneys on the entire Eastern Seaboard. He was there to talk face-to-face with an old classmate from Yale who'd since taken a high position in the Georgia state government. Over lunch, the two men shared shrimp cocktails and pan-fried Chateaubriand at the Capital City Club, one of the most elite fine dining establishments in the entire country. And we know that because a copy of the bill exists in the state archives over in Morrow. Then that very same afternoon, a team of agents from the Bureau of Investigation, which was only 10 years away from becoming the FBI, arrived in Varnal and began interviewing the new sheriff, as well as the deputies who'd once served under Harding, regarding the murder of one Lily May McDermott. They reviewed evidence, re-interviewed the deputies, and sought out character witnesses for both Fast Eddie and Sheriff Harding. Then by month's end, They turned up the heat so bad that one of the deputies finally cracked and agreed to testify against his fellow officers in exchange for avoiding the state's brand new method of execution, the electric chair. And legend has it that this is how those BOI boys got the deputy to crack. The governor claimed the electric chair was the bleeding edge in dispatching murderers both quickly and painlessly. And after a rigorous testing phase, don't ask, the chair became the state's primary method of execution. But some devious BOI agent starts telling the deputies how that's all a bunch of horse crap, how he's seen the electric chair in action with his own eyes, and how, even with all the crap he saw in the trenches over in France, it was still the most ugly, haunting, and horrifying thing he's ever seen in his whole life. He terrorized those deputies by telling them how the chair cooks men alive, how they shriek and wail for their mamas to make it stop as their skin blisters and their eyes boil. He said he'd seen a man burst into flames, another who cried tears of blood, and a third who endured hours upon hours of almost constant agony, pissing in his britches and soiling himself until his heart finally gave up and exploded in his chest. If one of the deputies didn't do the right thing and told the truth about what happened to Lily May, then all of them would be headed to the electric chair, and all of them were going to burn. I guess it only took so much of that kind of box talk before one of them cracked, and when he did, the whole rotten house came tumbling down around them. No one ended up going to the electric chair, not since all attested that it was Sheriff Harding that had wielded the lug wrench and written the false confession. But at their sentencing, the judge made no bones regarding their associated guilt, and wondered aloud how men who'd sworn to uphold the law had so suddenly seen fit to break it. What he also wondered aloud was who exactly had prompted the hotshot prosecutor to come all the way down from Washington, D.C. to work on a case that no one believed would bear fruit. That's when the attorney informed the judge that his wealthy benefactor was, in fact, sitting in that very same courtroom with them, and directed his attention to the gallery where a woman in black sat with a long black veil covering her face. As the court turned to look at her, the woman lifted her veil and, although not all those in attendance recognized her, the revelation drew gasps from those that did. It was the widow, Mary Pettimore, Fast Eddie's grieving mother. Much like her son, Mary had lived frugally, especially considering that she was set on a nest egg of almost $500,000, which would be worth almost $10 million in today's money. Her attitude to it was very much easy come, easy go. So instead of spending it and risking alerting people to her family's vast hidden riches, she let the cash pile up for years on end, until the day arrived when she finally had a reason to spend it. And spend it she did. And that's how she ended up in D.C., greasing the wheels of power with all her accumulated wealth, until she found herself sitting in the office of that hotshot prosecutor who brought the hammer down on the Whitfield County sheriffs. She tasked him with clearing the name of her first and only child, and it was a task that he went on to accomplish with style. It meant a lot to those who cared, but in the grand scheme of things, it didn't really change much. Those that loved Eddie carried on loving him, and those that didn't carried on doing just the same. Little Bill Harding was now officially a murderer, but he was dead. Hated in life, and then hated in death, and Eddie was dead too. The news hit state law enforcement hard, but it made barely a ripple in Whitfield County. It's not like the sheriff's department wanted to go hollering about what had happened, and there was no official apology or anything. Not like there would be if it happened today. I guess that's why folks started telling this story in the first place, so people really know what happened between Fast Eddie, Little Bill, and Lily May. Because a man doesn't die when he passes away, not really. His true death comes when there's no one left to remember him, when that final memory of him flickers out, and he's forever forgotten. I don't know how we lost Afghanistan. As a former Army officer who served for 14 years with the 503rd Infantry Regiment, I feel like I should be able to provide some kind of cogent answer to the question of how one of the largest and most technologically advanced militaries on the planet just turned tail and ran one day. But I can't. And over the next decade, you're going to see 100 different books, movies, articles, documentaries, and TV specials all attempting to explain what happened during the summer of 2021. They'll talk about how rumors of a Taliban troop build up boar fruit, how they captured town after town as they slowly surrounded Kabul, and how what started with innocent Americans falling from the 100th floor of One World Trade Center ended with innocent Afghans falling from the wheel wells of a soaring C-17. But it'll take a long, long time to be able to piece it all together and properly explain how the finest fighting force the world has ever known managed to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. That's something I could never hope to achieve on my own. But what I can do is tell you how the United States managed to lose one very specific district nestled up in the mountains of Kunar province, named Asadabad. Asadabad is the smallest of Kunar's 16 administrative districts and consists of a small village from which it derives its name, along with a 50-mile-long strip of flat, fertile valley carved out by the Kunar River. It's home to around 35,000 people, a third of which live in the village while the rest are scattered around the valley floor in mud brick compounds that are almost 1,000 years old. It's a pretty unremarkable place in eastern Afghanistan, and if you don't know what I mean by that, think crystal clear blue skies, stunning semi-alpine vistas, and grinding subsistence poverty. But what did make Asadabad remarkable was the fact that its district center was only 7 miles away from the Pakistani border, which made it a major smuggling route for the Taliban's weapons as well as its opium. I know those guys waged a major PR campaign after they took over and made a big deal out of eradicating Afghanistan's poppy fields to show how anti-vice they are. But when they needed money for weapons and ammunition, the Taliban had no problem allowing opium traffickers to ply their trade, just as long as they got a tasty cut of the profits via the heavy taxes they imposed. They made a lot of money that way too. So in the winter of 2008, we rolled into Asadabad with the goal of cutting off their smuggling routes. The first problem we encountered was that Asadabad's chief of police was corrupt to the core. He was taking money from the Taliban to keep his officers away from certain areas. He was taking money from the smugglers to turn a blind eye to their operators. He was also taking money from a group of guerrillas turned gangsters called the Haqqani Network. But try as we might, we could never figure out why they were paying him, only that they were. And so the first thing on the agenda was finding a replacement. The 503rd might have been responsible for the combat and supply end of things, but all of the civilian administration fell under the jurisdiction of the Department of State. The DOS had an HQ over in Kabul, and every so often, they'd fly over a representative on a Chinook to liaise with our battalion commander. And then one day, the DOS Chinook touches down at our battalion HQ, but the representative isn't alone. He brought the chief of police's replacement with him, and his name was Najibullah. Chief Najibullah belonged to a large family that, for reasons that were never fully explained to us, had been kicked out of Asadabad many years earlier by the Taliban. Najibullah and his boys hated those guys, and we were very confident that they'd perform better than their predecessors, who had melted away whenever the Taliban launched attacks. Then, with more of the Taliban's fighters tied down in Asadabad, it would be much easier for the teams of Green Berets to swoop in on the smugglers' transport routes and choke off the enemy's largest source of revenue and supply. At least, that was the plan. But whenever I think of plans these days, I'm reminded of a poem that I had memorized back at West Point. But little mouse, you're not alone, and proving foresight may be vain. The best laid plans of mice and men go oft awry, and leave us only grief and pain. For the first couple of weeks, Najibullah and his boys performed exactly as expected, and they were a huge upgrade compared to the police officers the previous regimental combat team had worked with. Having our Afghan national police officers actually doing their jobs added a very fragile but much-needed layer of security to the district, which meant the Taliban started to have problems maneuvering, evacuating wounded fighters, and getting ammunition to their key firing points during firefights. As you can imagine, that made our offensive operations run much smoother and meant that we finally started to make some serious progress in terms of stopping the flow of weapons and opium going back and forth across the border with Pakistan. Najibullah was tough, and he had an ego about him, but the effect that he had on our area of operations was phenomenal. And so for a while, we were all his number one fans. But then, when the winter came to an end, and as the spring fighting season started to approach, we noticed that Najibullah's methods of enforcing the law were becoming more and more robust, for lack of a better word. One morning, around the middle of February, word filtered down the chain of command that a village elder had approached Battalion HQ to make a complaint about Najibullah. The chief, along with some of his fellow officers, had been searching a compound in the valley when a young boy began to talk back to him. Najibullah flew into a rage and started smacking this kid around. Then, when the boy's father demanded that he stop, Najibullah ordered one of his officers to hold the father at gunpoint and then proceeded to beat the man's son even harder. By the time the village elder arrived at Battalion HQ, the wounded kid, who turned out to be the elder's great-nephew, had been carried all the way to the small medical clinic in near Asadabad's district center and was receiving treatment for a broken eye socket and a severe concussion. The village elder then said that he managed to convince the boy's father not to kill Najibullah and his boys, but that in order for a lasting peace, he'd require ample monetary compensation. If there was one thing that was never short of in Afghanistan, it was cash. So getting the elder and his family their money was never going to be an issue. But on the other hand, the amount of goodwill we had with the local Afghans was, at the very best, minimal. And so after arranging for a family representative to swim by to pick up their cash, a few officers went over to the district center to talk to Najibullah about his conduct. But when confronted, he seemed confused. Through the translator, Najibullah explained that as part of his training, he'd been told how he had to win the respect of the local population. But how were the people going to respect him, he asked, if they didn't fear him? By the time the spring fighting season commenced, we'd convinced Najibullah that his enemies should fear arrest and detention, not corporal punishment or death. He promised he and his officers would follow the procedural guidelines we provided and would arrest all future suspects instead of just kicking the crap out of them on the spot. I heard one officer say that dealing with Najibullah was like pulling teeth, but honestly, I think it was more like herding cats. He gave the A&P guys all the guidance in the world, and they still just did their own thing. Sometimes their own thing proved very effective. Like this one time when they rolled back into the district center carrying several kilos of raw opium they'd confiscated from some smugglers who they'd managed to ambush, forced to surrender, without even a single shot being fired. I remember asking Najibullah why he'd planned such a risky operation. And you know what he told me? He was bored. The Afghans were often crazy brave like that, and it saved the lives of my soldiers many times over. But then other times, the crap they pulled almost got a lot of them killed. One morning, the boys in 2nd Platoon performed a little advance-to-contact patrol at the western end of the valley. They were kind of like the search-and-destroy missions from Vietnam. Soldiers patrolled deeper and deeper into enemy territory until the enemy began shooting at them. But then if the soldiers were fired upon, they knew that they were headed in the right direction, at which point they'd advance under fire, destroy or rout the Taliban, then return to their operating bases for coffee and MREs. There was a place where 99 times out of 100, we'd start taking AK fire once we arrived. But then on one particular morning, an eerie silence hung over the landscape and the Taliban were nowhere to be found. That marked the first time ever that we'd reached that western point in the valley and not been fired upon, so naturally we were very keen on figuring out why that was. My platoon made its way back to our FOB, then a detachment consisting of myself and a few guys from 2nd Squad walked all the way into the district center to speak to the lieutenant colonel and give a full, in-person report on what had happened that morning, or more accurately, what hadn't happened that morning. The moment we walked into the compound which housed the district center, which consisted of a whole bunch of administrative buildings, we saw some of Najib's boys hanging out smoking cigarettes and drinking chai. This wasn't out of the ordinary because it was approaching the hottest part of the day when the Afghans traditionally took a break. But as we walked past and said our salams, one of them says in broken English, "Taliban finish, Captain. Today, Taliban go home. No fighting." Me and my guy stopped dead in our tracks, like, wait, what? How did they know? While Najib's guys had these big grins on their faces. It was possible that they too had noticed the absence of Taliban fighters that morning, but those big crap-eating grins made me suspect that they knew something we didn't. The second we walked into the room that served as the Lieutenant Colonel's daytime office, we saw Najib, smiling like he'd just found an extra fry at the bottom of his bag. It turns out, during the previous night, he and his boys had gone out into the valley and paid a visit to one of the compounds out there. They didn't barge their way in, and they didn't break anyone's skull either. In fact, all they did was arrest a villager suspected of supplying information to the Taliban. The Lieutenant Colonel was telling me all of that, which, to me, sounded like good news. But the look of disquiet on his face told me that there was a little more to the story, and boy was there ever. The suspect Najibullah had arrested was the mother of the Assadabad Taliban commanders, and in all likelihood, she had indeed provided her son with some kind of material support. But before that day, women and children were off limits. A brother or father that helped build an IED, they could expect to be shipped off to Kabul for a long spell in Pulicharki prison. But we knew that to mess with Afghan women, or worse, mess with their children, and you'd be asking for serious trouble. But then if Najib had just arrested some commander's mom, why wasn't the whole valley popping off with RPG and mortar fire? Well, that's because Najib had asked the woman's family to pass a message on to the Taliban commander, and that message was this. If one single bullet is fired by a Taliban rifle, or a single IED explodes anywhere in the valley, then the commander's mother would be tortured, violated, and then executed. We asked if Najib had proof of the mom's material support, and in response, he asked why we needed it. He knew her son was Taliban, everyone did, and to him, that was all the proof anyone needed. If we wanted to beat the Taliban, he said through the translator, then we had to start hitting them where it hurt. I had to then explain again through the translator how that was not at all what we wanted to do, and we told Najib that 100 times. We wanted to win hearts and minds and contribute to the cycle of violence as little as possible in our efforts to remove the Taliban. So, without any real evidence of her guilt, he was going to have to release the Taliban commander's mom, and he had to do it immediately. Needless to say, Najibullah was not happy about being ordered to release his prisoner, and accused us of undermining his authority. He also said that the moment the commander's mother had reached safety, the Taliban would attack our positions with everything they had, and he was right. We just had a hard time explaining how, when that happened, it would be all his fault, but continued to keep her prisoner and whatever consequences we had in store would be much worse. The second we delivered the commander's mom back to her compound, families started packing up and leaving the Assadabad Valley to seek shelter elsewhere. They knew what was coming, and so did we. But when it came, we were ready for it. In what amounted to an extremely reckless attack, the Taliban attacked every forward operating base we had, all while dropping 82 and 120mm mortars onto the district center. It was a revenge attack, but because they rushed and mounted, we scored exactly 33 Taliban KIA while suffering only one wounded soldier. It was the largest multi-contact firefight we'd experienced thus far, and it had been a complete turkey shoot. But then, who goes and takes the credit for it? Najib goddamn Bullah. He claimed that it was he that had tricked the Taliban into a hasty and disastrous attack, all by merely pretending to arrest one of their commander's moms. And the worst thing was, all the villagers believed it. That's not to say Najib and his boys didn't stand their ground and fight like tigers. They did, and all the civilians who hadn't evacuated the district center saw them doing it. But instead of just chalking one up for the visitors, Najib spun the whole thing into a huge PR victory for himself, which in all fairness delighted everyone further up the chain of command. They were relying on him to win the villagers' respect, and having finally done so, regimental command didn't want anyone pissing on his parade. They told us to back off, let him do this thing, and focus on consolidating the strategic advantage following our recent victory. So that's what we did. But once he figured out that he was working unsupervised, Najib not only went back to his less scrupulous ways, he got way, way worse than before. The first sign of it was when we took some of Najib's A&P guys with us on a patrol, and while we were taking a break to hydrate, they walked away from the larger group. They told the translator that they were going to the bathroom, but maybe a minute later, the very strong smell of marijuana came floating in on the breeze. One of my soldiers then walks around the corner of the compound wall while we were sheltering behind, where he finds the two A&P soldiers sitting on the edge of an irrigation ditch, high out of their minds on what smelled like some very strong pot. I asked them through the translator, "What would Najibullah say if he found out about this?" But the officers just laughed and told us that it was Najibullah himself that had given them the marijuana. I didn't believe them at first because the Afghans had this way of telling you pointless little lies as a way of saying either mind your own business or go F yourself. Like when one of my soldiers' Oakley sunglasses went missing after a patrol, and we saw what looked like a 70-year-old farmer wearing an identical pair just a few days later. I asked where he got his sunglasses, then after looking me dead in the eye and thinking about it for a couple of seconds, he told me, "I made them," and walked off. It was such a huge lie that it was almost worth admiration, just like a couple of police officers telling me their chief gave them pot to smoke on patrol. But the crazy thing is, Najibullah really did give those two officers a bunch of pot, and he did it as a reward for going out on patrol with us. When we got back from patrol, we went to see Najib and tell him about his two pot-smoking officers. But when he walked into the old Soviet police building he'd taken for his HQ, it looked more like a Snoop Dogg video than a police station. A handful of A&P were sitting around a little satellite TV, passing around a hash pipe and giggling like teenagers. When we walked into Najib's office, he was just sitting behind his desk, with his eyes so pink they look infected, staring at this big old pile of money. Then behind him, in like an old-timey cloth sack, was the largest amount of marijuana I had ever seen. We got the translator in and asked him where he got all the marijuana. Officially speaking, marijuana was illegal under the laws of the new Afghan government, but unofficially, it was tolerated so we could focus on dealing with the opium crop, which was how the Taliban made most of their money. Plus, marijuana had been part of the lives of everyday Afghans for literally thousands of years. Telling them to stop would have felt pointless. And on top of that, it would have been exceptionally rude for Najib to refuse the farmer's gift. But that wasn't our issue. The issue was that Najib couldn't allow his officers to be smoking on duty, and neither should he for that matter. Najib just sort of rolled his eyes as the translator relayed our scolding reply, then promised that they wouldn't smoke on duty anymore. But just days later, he went back on his word and explained that he needed to give his officers marijuana to smoke or they'd refuse to go out on patrol. And that was complete horse crap, but it wasn't really marijuana use that was bothering us. It was all that money that he had on the table. The money that was given to Najib to pay his officers always came perfectly stacked and shrink-wrapped, and it was all brand new, crisp, clean bills. But the bills in the pile of cash on Najib's table looked old, creased, and used. We asked if he was taxing the villagers or taking bribes of some description, but he took terrible offense to that and insisted that it was his officers' pay. We were soldiers, not cops, so there was only so much we could do in terms of tracking down where the money came from. And even if we could prove that he was taxing the local villagers, which was well beyond his authority, he could just reframe the taxes as gifts and then intimidate the villagers into corroborating his story. If it sounds like Najib has a pretty solid grip on local power, that's because he did, But although he was helping keep the Taliban at bay, he was causing more and more problems as the power went more and more to his head. But the thing that I have about power is it requires a hell of a lot of self-discipline, because without it, you don't just lose the men under you, you lose yourself too. About a week or so later, we were still trying in vain to get one of the villagers to admit that Najib had been taxing them. They were all so scared of him at first, and it seemed like no one was going to tell the truth. Then suddenly, someone came forward with an incredible accusation. Two farmers, brothers whose families lived in the same compound, finally confirmed other suspicions that Najib had been taxing them. Yet they also claimed that after discovering his family was unable to pay, Najib had kidnapped one of the farmer's 9-year-old twin sons as a form of collateral. Since that totally sounded like something Najib would do, me and the company first sergeant grabbed our translator and went over to the district center to demand their release. But when we arrived, we were barred entry to the office. Two extremely stone-looking A&P officers told us that Najib was busy and that we should come back later. Through our translator, we told them that Najib didn't sound very busy because we could hear Pashtun pop music blaring from a stereo inside his office. The officers kept insisting Najib wasn't taking any visitors, and in the end, we had to threaten with having every single one of them removed from their posts before they stepped aside and allowed us into the office. But when me and that first sergeant opened up the door and walked inside, neither of us could believe what we were seeing. We were looking for two missing boys, right? And I honestly figured Najib was holding them in the old station's large undivided jail cell. But when the first sergeant and I walked into his office and we saw Najib sitting behind his desk with his shirt open, while a small girl stood in front of his desk, dancing in time with the music. I say little girl because the kid had a dress on, little sandals with bells on, and was wearing what appeared to be makeup. The same could be said for what I thought was a second little girl who was lying under a blanket on the opposite side of the room, wearing this dead-eyed expression on her face. That all lasted for only about half a second because the second Najib saw us, he turned down the music and then started yelling at our translator. I figured our translator would wait to hear him out and then start translating, but instead, he started yelling back at Najibullah as he went over to grab the dancing girl. The whole time I'm yelling at our translator, "Ask him where the girls came from." But he's still yelling at Najib, who's yelling back at him. And then finally, after screaming so loud at Najib that I thought he was going to shoot him, our translator turns to me and says, "They're not girls. They're boys. The two missing boys." He then asked me to help carry the kid lying in the corner who turned out to be completely naked under that blanket. Now, side note, I just literally had to get up and pace around the room for a while because what I'm about to go into is possibly the most disturbing and upsetting thing I've ever learned in my whole life. And for those of you that are about to be eternally scarred by what I'm about to tell you, then I sincerely apologize. And for those of you that don't believe me, then I implore you to look it up, because every word of what I'm about to tell you is true. In Afghanistan and northern Pakistan, certain men practice an ancient tradition that they refer to as bachabazi. Bachabazi is when older men take a young boy who hasn't gone through puberty yet, and then they dress him up like a little girl and make him dance. Now, this might just sound a little goofy or perhaps a little cruel, but it gets way worse than that. Because after they're done making the boy dance, the older men in attendance take turns doing things that no grown man should be doing with a child. Seeing it up close for the first time, but only seeing the dancing phase, the first sergeant and I had no idea what we were looking at. But our translator did, and after handing over the kid that he was carrying to the first sergeant, we had to talk him out of walking back into the police HQ and shooting Najibullah dead. As you can imagine, we reported what Najib had been doing to regimental command, but what we were told was jaw-dropping. We were told that it was an internal issue, a problem only the Afghans had the remit to solve, and since Najib was still coasting on the victory of the late spring, none of his superiors wanted to replace him. And in so many words, we were told to ignore it. And hearing that made us feel physically sick. But even worse, we had no choice but to try and keep word from spreading among the soldiers. And that is something that still keeps me up at night. If I allowed the details of Najib's nightly activities to spread among the platoons, one of my soldiers would end up fragging him. And despite me also wanting to end his life, if Najib ended up dead, a veritable shitstorm was sure to follow. Our only hope was that one of the higher-ups saw fit to replace him, and sooner rather than later, because Najib's popularity among the villagers that didn't already hate him was starting to plummet. We knew things were reaching a breaking point when some of the ANP officers started to desert their posts. Not all of them were okay with him diddling kids in his office, no matter how much cash or dope he offered them, and he did end up diddling more kids in that office. And so one by one, all of his guys just up and deserted in the middle of the night, until all that were left were a handful of his brothers and cousins, who, for the record, were also taking part in the bacha-bazi sessions. We ended up pleading with our CO to get on the horn to Kabul, because we needed at least a dozen new ANP officers to maintain security around the valley floor. But before that could ever happen, everything suddenly came to a head. Remember the guy who we delivered cash compensation to after his nephew talked back to Najibullah and got his ass beat? Well, we're out on patrol one day and he's out working one of his fields as we're passing. Then when he sees us, he comes running over and starts yelling at our translator, saying he needs to talk to us. The farmer and our translator then talk for a good few minutes before finally they stop talking and our translator turns to me. It looked like he was struggling to find the words for a second, then when he spoke, all he said was, "I think you need to pull your guys out of the district center tonight." I asked him why, and he tells me, "Trust me, take your guys out of the DC or they'll all be killed." Obviously, I'm not taking orders from a damn translator, no matter how much I like the guy, so I order him to start making sense already and to tell me what the farmer had said. According to the translator, the farmer was talking indirectly, in riddles almost, because he couldn't be heard giving Americans information on Taliban attacks. But essentially, what the guy was trying to tell us was that something big was coming, and it was coming that night, and it was going to be bad. Not one to run from a fight, I started asking our translator what exactly made him think that we couldn't repel a night attack. Seeing as we had around $100,000 worth of night vision equipment with us, I didn't think that posed a significant threat, but the translator was insistent. He told me we couldn't stop what was coming, that from the way the farmer talked, every Taliban fighter in Kunar was headed our way, probably to even the score for the losses they suffered back in spring. Without boring you with too much of the strategic stuff, let's just say that there was no way that we could adequately reinforce the DC against an attack that large without abandoning the operating bases in the surrounding hills. But if we abandoned those bases, the Taliban could simply move into our old positions, concentrate their fire on the district center, and the whole company would be up shit creek without a paddle. But then, leave our soldiers at the DC and they suffer a concentrated attack, they might be KIA before the cavalry even gets there to relieve them. So as you can see, we had no real choice but to pull them out, which, in turn, left Najibullah and his boys just a little more vulnerable than before, but still capable of defending themselves should they need to. That night, up in one of the hillside outposts, we watched and waited for the Taliban to attack. There was no way that, if they had numbers, the Taliban would focus their attack on the district center. That's just not how they operated. They like to tie you down in as many places as possible, then have assault teams try and get closer to you once you're pinned. So, if they were going to attack the district center, they'd have to hold us in place at the hillside outpost before they attacked the district center. Then, once we thought we'd figured that out, it was just a matter of watching, waiting, and being ready for anything. Taliban attacks usually came from the direction of the setting sun, and they take advantage of the sun's glare to blind you to their firing positions. No shots were fired at sundown, so we figured the attack was coming later, and then sometime after midnight, we saw the headlights of a truck approaching Assadabad's district center. It was a lone vehicle, so we didn't immediately suspect it was the Taliban, especially not if they were planning on attacking in large numbers. Then as we watched the vehicle roll past the district center and towards Najib's police HQ, it stopped outside the compound's main gates. We were up on the hillside so we could watch all this unfolding at a distance. Then as the truck's headlights started illuminating the interior of the compound, we figured, okay, it must have been an A&P vehicle or something to be allowed entry into the compound. We all start to relax, thinking the warning of the attack might have been a false alarm, then out of nowhere, boom. The flash of the explosion lit up the hillsides as this huge orange fireball rose up from the valley floor. We all got into position, waiting for the Taliban to start firing on our hillside positions, but nothing came. Correctly assuming that it was a bomber that had just hit the police HQ, we had a few guys from 2nd Platoon rush down to the DC to defend against any follow-up attacks. But again, nothing happened. In the morning after the attack, we got to get a good look at the damage inflicted, then started pulling out bodies from the police HQ, which included Najibullah's. His body was covered in purple and black contusions from the force of the explosion, and his head had been half crushed, presumably by falling rubble. The explosive device the truck had been fitted with was so big that it had killed every one of the police officers guarding the HQ and killed all but one of those inside. The force of the explosion had thrown him off his feet, and apparently he'd landed on his neck, leaving him in a pretty bad way. He could talk, but when we asked him what had happened in the run-up to the explosion, he told us he had no idea. But we didn't have to wait long to find out what had happened. Back then, the Taliban used these small, cheap Motorola radios to communicate with each other, called ICOMs. But we loved those little things because all you had to do to listen in to their chatter was buy your own ICOM radio, then tune into their frequency. We had someone monitoring their radio traffic almost constantly, and while it had been relatively quiet the night before, they knew that we were listening, so they'd go tactically quiet before an attack. The following day had unleashed a beehive of activity. The Taliban were proud of what they pulled off, and they had a right to be, because this was their plan. First off, they'd spread rumors of a huge coordinated attack on Assadabad. Then, once we were all sitting in our positions, waiting for said attack, they simply drove a stolen A&P vehicle right up to the gates of the police compound and asked to be let inside. Knowing the A&P guys wouldn't recognize the disguised Taliban driver, they had to think of something that would have the A&P letting their guard down, and that thing was this. The driver rolled up to the compound, then when questioned on who he was, as well as what was in the truck, the driver told the guard on duty that he brought 3 Bachabazi boys to Najibullah as a gift for defeating the Taliban back in the spring. This was all the guards needed to hear, and then after parking his truck right next to the HQ building, the driver simply grabbed his detonator, shouted "God is great," and then blew the whole compound to kingdom come. Killing Najibullah, along with those still loyal to him, was a huge PR victory for the local Taliban. And without A&P officers to back us up and curtail the smuggling, the Taliban had the upper hand. This made the remainder of our tour much, much tougher than it had to be, and I have no doubt in my mind that it contributed to the loss of American life during our subsequent combat operations. But without a doubt, the most significant impact it had was turning the local population violently and irreversibly against us. Under the watch of the United States military, a sick, evil man had been permitted to abuse little boys, and not just on one occasion either. It's suspected that Najibullah and his officers kidnapped more than a dozen children before abusing them in lieu of illegal taxes he'd imposed on their families. If someone did that to me, and one of my kids, I'd do just about anything to see them dead, and I wouldn't shed a tear if the people protecting the abuser died either. Especially if they'd come from some faraway place and had long outstayed their welcome. Like I said at the beginning, I can't tell you exactly how or why we lost the war in Afghanistan. I just know we wouldn't be the first great power to admit defeat there. Because as our own society begins to display some subtle and not so subtle signs of decline, perhaps Afghanistan will once again have earned its nickname as the graveyard of Empires. Hey friends, thanks for listening. Click that notification bell to be alerted of all future narrations. I release new videos every Monday and Thursday at 9 p.m. EST, and there are super fun live streams on Sundays and Wednesday nights. If you get a story, be sure to submit them to my email over at letsreadsubmissions@gmail.com, and you might even hear your story featured on the next video. And if you want to support me even more, grab early access to all future narrations and bonus content over on Patreon, or click that big join button to hear about the extra perks offered for members of the channel. And check out the Let's Read podcast, where you can hear all of these stories in big compilations located anywhere you listen to podcasts. All links in the description below. Thanks so much, friends. And remember, I wish I was pregnant.